Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
In her new book, American Dharma, Buddhism Beyond Modernity, Anne Glegg makes a major contribution to scholarship on American Buddhism. Glegg focuses on meditation-based convert Buddhist lineages in North America, and in particular, she is interested in the generational changes underway in these groups. The first generations of convert Buddhist teachers often modernized the tradition in distinctly American ways, and now Gen X and millennial Buddhists are re-engaging with the tradition, but bringing to their Buddhist practice and teaching new questions. The issues that they tackle and that Glegg addresses in her study include mindfulness as a secular and commercialized practice, sex scandals, and new technologies. These Buddhists ask how their communities should address racism and social injustice and what the goal of practice should be. Glegg sets her fine-grained ethnographic research within a larger discussion of Buddhist modernism, arguing for new ways to understand convert Buddhism in America. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies. I'm Natasha Heller. Today, we'll be talking to Anne Glegg about her new book, American Dharma, Buddhism Beyond Modernity. Welcome to the show, and thanks so much for taking time to speak with us.
Hi, Natasha. Thank you for the invitation.
So I wonder, Anne, if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself and how you got into this field of study.
Yeah, sure. So I think I first encountered Buddhism as a teenager through, I guess, what we would call beat Buddhism. So the Buddhism of, you know, Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and Alan Watts. And I kind of discovered those texts as a teenager. And then a few years later, when it was time for me to, you know, go to university in England, I wanted to, you know, kind of start a more serious study of Buddhism and Hinduism. I was really attracted to Buddhist and Hindu philosophy. So my first academic encounter with Buddhism came in 1992 to Bristol University. And I studied mostly there with Rupert Gethin and Paul Williams, who have both written quite influential textbooks on Buddhism. An introduction. Rupert Gethin's done a lot of work on Theravada Buddhism, and Paul Williams wrote a great book on Mahayana philosophy. So that was my really first kind of existential and academic encounter with Buddhism. And then I went straight on to do my MA, and I was actually planning to, I'd started off studying, I wanted to study Chinese Buddhism, and I was drawn to Hawaiian philosophy. So I actually went to Lancaster University, I think it was probably in 1995. But I was really, you know, I was kind of challenged at Lancaster University by, it was a time when postmodernism and post-structuralism and intersectional feminism was really taken off. So it kind of got me really questioning, you know, what were the relevance of me as a young kind of queer kind of feminist, you know, the relevance of studying Buddhism. So that kind of threw me a little bit. So I ended up finishing my MA. I actually went in a more general religious studies direction. And then I ended up taking, I think, about 7 years out of school. I spent a couple of those years in Asia practicing Buddhism in Nepal and India. And then I returned to academia. I went to Rice University in 2004 with the intention of studying with Anne Klein in Tibetan Buddhism and Jeffrey Kripal. And whilst at Rice, a few factors kind of led me more into the direction of American Buddhism and also Hinduism in America. So my actual dissertation is not the book. It's a different, it's a related project, but a different project that was a kind of comparative study of Buddhism and Hinduism through a kind of American metaphysical lens. And then my post, you know, since graduating from Rice in 2010, I kind of returned, focused more, you know, solely on Buddhism in America.
Great.
So yeah, that's a little background.
So I could tell, because, you know, so much of your work in this book is fairly recent, that this must be just sort of an ongoing emerging project. How did you come to write this particular book?
Yeah, it is definitely all happening in real time, which, you know, poses its own kind of challenges. So with this particular book, essentially what happened was, after I finished my dissertation, you know, my plan, of course, was to turn the dissertation into a book. But, you know, like a lot of, you know, recently minted graduates, I, you know, really felt like I needed a break. So I basically embarked on a couple of separate kind of ethnographic projects. So I did an ethnography of the East Bay Meditation Society in Oakland, California. And I also did an ethnography of the Buddhist Geeks online kind of community. And although they were two, you know, on the face, on the surface, they're two very different communities, but in kind of theorizing the ethnographic kind of data, I really felt that Buddhist modernism, which, as you know, is the kind of dominant framework for understanding contemporary Buddhism, I really felt like it was limited, that it wasn't, you know, sufficient to account for what was happening in these two different communities. So I wrote two separate articles, one in each community, in which I kind of theorized that, you know, the things that are happening in real time in these communities were best illuminated by thinking beyond modernity, by thinking into the postmodern, and in the case of the East Bay Meditation Society, the post-colonial. So I just, you know, I published those two articles, and then essentially what happened was Franz Metcalf, who is a senior scholar in Buddhist studies, he was, I think, one of the reviewers for the Buddhist Geeks article that was published in the Journal of Global Buddhism. And he kind of reached out to me, and we, you know, started a conversation about my research. And he really encouraged me to turn the article into a book. Like, he was, you know, he basically said, there's definitely enough for a book project here. So I was, you know, still kind of putting off changing the dissertation into a book. And so I was kind of grateful. I had more energy and curiosity around this project. Then I was really fortunate. I, you know, just kind of whipped up an introduction and just kind of fell into the hands of Jennifer Banks, an editor at Yale. And she really, you know, kind of took a chance on me and got me a advanced contract, and, you know, that kind of pushed me forward. And then, yeah, the result is American Dharma.
Right. Fantastic. So turning to the book itself, in the introduction, you explain that your work draws on both discourse analysis and multi-site ethnography. And you just mentioned ethnography in a couple of with the Buddhist Geeks. Could you say something a little bit more about your sources from this project and how you carried out the research?
The project is very hybridic. You know, I think I also talk in the introduction, I, you know, locate myself as a scholar and my own positionality. And in a way, you know, I think in many ways, my positionality is also quite postmodern, kind of post-colonial. And in terms of the methodology, I mean, essentially, for me, the primary question in the book was, you know, what's happening to Buddhist modernism? So I look at North American convert lineages as a way to look at Buddhist modernism. So the book is called American Dharma. So the title of the book leads with the convert communities themselves. But for me, you know, intellectually, my, you know, primary question was really about what's happening with Buddhist modernism. And so because I wasn't interested in just one community, I wanted to think about, you know, different spaces in which, you know, Buddhist modernist kind of phenomena was occurring. So David McMahon's book, The Making of Buddhist Modernism, which is a very foundational text for me and also, you know, in Buddhist studies, he, I think, correctly identifies, you know, the insight community and the Zen communities as, you know, as really rich sites to think about Buddhist modernism. And so I did multi-sited ethnography in these different communities. And that involved, I mean, each chapter in a way has its own, is based in a mix of ethnography and textual discourse analysis. So I think the two ethnographically heavy chapters in the book are probably the Gen X chapter on the Gen X teachers. So for that chapter, I interviewed, I think, 33 Gen X teachers. And those interviews took place via Skype. I think they all took place via Skype because, you know, the teachers are all scattered all across America and some even in Europe. So Skype was a kind of lifesaver. So I did, you know, interviews between, I think, 1 and 3 hours and then follow-up questions in nearly all of the cases. And then, you know, for other chapters, you know, for example, there's the chapter on meditation. I did some participant observation. So I went, I think the chapter opens with a snapshot of Josh Korda. So I went to Josh Korda's, I went to a retreat that he did in the Garrison Institute. I also went to his groups. He runs weekly groups. He has a sit in New York and in Brooklyn. So I attended some of those sits. And then in other cases, some of it was, you know, in person, in, you know, actual physical meditation retreat sites. Other ethnographic research was done, you know, via Skype interviews. And then a lot of it was also done online. So with the Pragmatic Dharma community, for example, that's also in that chapter, you know, that's almost an entirely online community. So that just involved really hours and really over, you know, the course of several years of just kind of being on the web boards and, you know, doing interviews with prominent speakers. And with the Buddhist Geeks chapter, I, you know, basically went to the three conferences. They did, I think they did 4 conferences. I missed the first one, but I attended the next 3. So it was very kind of hybridic, you know, in real time ethnography and virtual time ethnography, and then a lot of interviews kind of via Skype.
Great. So you've already mentioned this idea of Buddhist modernism. And in the introduction, in the first chapter, you suggest that many of the phenomena that you see in contemporary meditation-based convert Buddhism in North America should be better understood as postmodern. Could you explain the distinction for listeners? How do you see this different?
Okay, well, I just qualify it a little because I do have some hesitations around the postmodern. So, you know, as you know, in my conclusion, I, you know, basically say, let's look at the postmodern, the post-colonial and the post-secular. So I think that, like, I don't think it's a good idea to replace, you know, talking about Buddhist modernism with Buddhist postmodernism. And the reason being is that I do think the postmodern is a really, you know, contentious signifier. And it does, you know, it means different things to different people. So I think the postmodern is, you know, the way I use it in the book in the introduction is really as a broad as a signifier to indicate broad sociocultural shifts that have kind of happened since, you know, the 1960s. And I guess some of the main features of, you know, the postmodern would be, you know, first of all, both a continuation of modernity, so a hyper-modernity, but also a critique of modernity. And so you've got these, you know, these two tracks that, you know, make up the postmodern as I understand it and use in the book. So I think, for example, you know, really to understand what's happening now is is necessary to kind of take a step back and think about Buddhist modernism. So when scholars like, you know, Don Lopez, David McMahon, you know, talk about Buddhist modernism, you know, they emphasize, you know, this a vision of Buddhism and form, not just a vision, but forms and lived communities of Buddhism that develop from the encounter between traditional Asian Buddhism and Western modernity under, you know, the conditions of colonialism. And so the forms of Buddhism that kind of emerge are, you know, this image of the Buddha as a scientific Buddha. You know, the Buddha is a kind of early scientist and Buddhism is the most rational religion. And then also, you know, David McMahon, I think, really helpfully uses Charles Taylor's work on modernity and takes out the three strands of the Enlightenment lineage, Romanticism, and liberal Protestantism, and then looks at the ways in which, you know, they show up in forms of Buddhism. So I just mentioned the scientific Buddha. Obviously, that would be a good example of the Enlightenment lineage. You know, an example of the Romantic lineage would really be this kind of, you know, this very kind of psychological, kind of therapeutic kind of iterations of Buddhism. And then liberal Protestantism, you know, a sense of, I think, of, you know, returning to the early suttas of the Buddha and really this privileging of meditation experience. And I think, you know, also really key to Buddhist modernism is this distinction between, you know, essential Buddhism or authentic Buddhism and cultural Buddhism. And so, and you know, the individual, you know, very individualistic. And so what I found in the communities that I was, you know, that I was looking at was that some of those really, you know, key characteristics of Buddhist modernism are actually coming under interrogation. So let me give you an example. So I think, you know, one clear example is that, you know, while meditation practice continues to be, you know, really important to the convert, you know, communities I look at, there's definitely a lot more, you know, reflection and action around, you know, that what happens after retreat, you know, what's Buddhist practice beyond the meditation cushion? And also, you know, what's the role of the Sangha? So there's a lot of movements towards not exactly recovering Sangha, because it's not exactly a return to Sangha as, you know, understood in traditional Asian Buddhism, but there is a kind of revisioning and a kind of celebration of community, you know, that is kind of starting to happen in these communities. And then I think around the, you know, essential cult, you know, the essential cultural Buddhism, you know, one way that divide is really being, you know, interrogated is around issues of race and the way in which that divide has been mapped on in American Buddhism has been kind of racialized. So, you know, that, you know, often, you know, white kind of converts have been, you know, mapped on to being practicing an essential Buddhism. The new Buddhism, you know, I think is what James Coleman kind of calls it in his text. And, you know, Asian heritage communities have been seen as, you know, cultural Buddhism. So I think you're seeing a lot of, you know, interrogation of that and reflections on, you know, the fact that, you know, all Buddhisms are enculturated. So I guess, you know, there's some of the ways on the ground in which changes are happening, which put, you know, some pressure on a modernist paradigm. And so what I do in the book is I basically, you know, take these case studies and I look at the end of the case studies, I kind of basically argue that what's happening in these case studies can't be contained within Buddhist modernism. So even with like the psychologization of Buddhism, I note that, you know, psychology is still a massive influential discourse within Buddhist communities, but there is a lot more conversation around, you know, differentiating between Buddhism and, you know, psychotherapy, you know, and not kind of, you know, I argue not just kind of, you know, merging them together. And so I think I use Bill Parsons' term and say these are more dialogical approaches that recognize difference. And so I then theorize that recognition of difference, you know, through a postmodern and a kind of post-colonial lens.
Right.
So, sorry, there was a lot there. Was that, did I kind of unpack?
Yeah, I think so. If I can backtrack a little bit, I'm wondering, you know, in chapter one is titled Buddhist Modernism from Asia to America. I'm wondering if you could say a little something about how you see modernism as playing out differently, you know, it's before we get to the kinds of studies that you're doing sort of in the moment, how Buddhist modernism played out differently in Asia and in America. So what are the key features that we might look for?
I think that's a really excellent question. So I think that, you know, for example, you know, when there was as you know, there's been a lot of critiques of the mindfulness movement from engaged Buddhists. And in the critiques of the mindfulness movement, you know, like say a scholar who is critiquing, say, someone like Jon Kabat-Zinn, you know, they point out, you know, they problematize the way that Jon Kabat-Zinn differentiates between Buddhism and the Dharma, you know, and they think this, you know, they think this is kind of problematic because, you know, it basically lends itself to a form of cultural appropriation. Like it makes the Dharma a kind of free floating entity that is, you know, basically there for anyone to kind of claim ownership of in a way that, you know, erases, you know, Asian heritage communities. But I think, you know, I think that's a really strong argument. But I think, you know, it's also a little problematic in the sense that, you know, you do find that same distinction between someone like Gwenka, you know. So someone like Gwenka, you know, who is, you know, I think one of the, you know, major Asian Buddhist modernists, you know, he's very clear, he often differentiates between, you know, essentially cultural Buddhism and the Dharma as this kind of living, you know, religious, spiritual kind of force. But so the rhetoric is the same. You do find this distinction between, you know, in a sense, religion, Buddhism, and the Dharma. But I think a big difference is that, you know, this distinction is happening in cultures that are really soaked in a Buddhist heritage. And so the context, I think, holds that distinction in a different way than a context in America, which is a highly, you know, individualistic society and, you know, a kind of a very commodified society. And then I think, you know, with, you know, even though there is, you know, in, you know, thinking about, you know, Burma and Eric Braun's book, you know, The Birth of Insight, you know, this is where the, you know, the mass kind of meditation movements start. So there is this kind of forefronting and privileging of meditation in Asian, you know, modern Buddhist modernism. But it's also, again, you know, it does take place within this wider backdrop of monastics teaching, you know, it starts off, you know, monastics teaching meditation and, you know, more kind of articulation of the wider Buddhist path. You know, like, you know, Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist ethics, Buddhist soteriology. So I think that, you know, the main difference is that the modernist features in Asian Buddhist modernism are kind of anchored to, you know, traditional kind of Buddhist kind of cultures and living communities in a way that seems to provide a different kind of balance than what happens when Asian, you know, when Buddhist modernism comes over to North America. And I think that, you know, just kind of, I think communities themselves and maybe even scholars are just kind of realizing, you know, the impact of the cultural, you know, having that cultural container or having what happens in a different cultural container. So I'd say that, you know, there's much more of an anchor for Buddhism in Asian Buddhist modernism than there in Asia than there is when it comes, you know, over to North America. Does that make sense?
Yes. So in other words, the cultural context for Buddhist modernism is really important.
Yeah, I think it's like super, super important because Like, for example, in American Dharma, I think it's either in my introduction or in chapter one, you know, I kind of summarize David's work. So, you know, massively really want to give a shout out to David because his work's been hugely important for my work and I know many others. So I kind of use his description of Buddhist modernism, but then I also add, you know, that another feature of Buddhist modernism in North America is white privilege, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that when, you know, this, you know, when the distinction between Dharma and Buddhism as a religion, you know, when that's articulated in a, you know, essentially a society with an ongoing history of racism, you know, as well as individualism, it becomes racialized in a really, you know, in a really problematic way. So that would be, I think, you know, in my book, one really graspable example of that kind of slippage of what happens with Buddhist modernist rhetoric and values in a different cultural context than, you know, than South Asia or, you know, East Asia, in which there is this, you know, these heritage, you know, communities and monastic communities, much, you know, much deeper roots.
Right. So beginning with chapter two, each chapter looks at an issue or challenge to the contemporary Buddhist community in greater depth. So chapter two takes up the mindfulness movement. How do North American convert Buddhists position themselves in relation to mindfulness teachings and practices?
Yeah, well, again, in multiple ways. So you've got, on the one hand, you know, some of the, you know, major players, you know, the main drivers in the secular mindfulness movement, you know, are teachers or, you know, senior students in, you know, the Insight community or, you know, the Zen community. And so, you know, people like Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, and also Asian Buddhist modernists like Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, they've been very, you know, enthusiastic about mindfulness and, you know, for the most part, supported Jon Kabat-Zinn's vision. But then, you know, as well as the drivers, you've also got, you know, a kind of backlash from other concerned Buddhists. I'd say there were two main groups, you know, of backlashers, backlash Buddhists. So I'd say there are more the traditionalists, and you can't see me, but I'm, you know, putting everything in quotation marks because obviously the terms are somewhat limited. But, you know, there's a traditionalist who, you know, I would say, I think Alan Wallace was an early fielded an early critique of mindfulness, secular mindfulness, and even mindfulness in the Insight community. And I think maybe Bhikkhu Bodhi, Ajahn, Jeff. So the traditionalists are basically, their issue is they're concerned with the difference between secular mindfulness and mindfulness as you find it in the, you know, the Pali canon. And so they're really looking at, you know, the concern that like the ethical foundations of mindfulness have dropped out of the picture, or their concern that, you know, mindfulness, you know, isn't, you know, geared towards, you know, nirvana, that it's geared towards stress reduction. So there's been a kind of, you know, critique from that side. And then another major body of critique has come from engaged Buddhists. And so with engaged Buddhists, I think a really good example would be David Loy and Ron Peirce's Beyond Mac Mindfulness article. And so essentially what they do is they combine a kind of traditionalist critique with, you know, what really a kind of neo-Marxist critique of the ways in which mindfulness is being, you know, individualized and kind of co-opted by neoliberalism. And they're particularly concerned that secular mindfulness doesn't address, you know, the structural sources of, you know, societal kind of injustices. But of course, you know, you don't find that concern in the Pali canon either. You know, the Buddha isn't really, you know, isn't concerned. I mean, there are readings, you know, there are these, you know, readings now of the, you know, of Buddhism that are, you know, creative hermeneutical readings of Buddhism that are thinking, you know, about, you know, dukkha as a kind of, on a collective level. But I think a strict traditionalist reading, you know, would not critique secular mindfulness on those grounds. But they're kind of merged together in the kind of engaged Buddhist critiques in a kind of very distinct way. So that's like, so you've got the, you know, you've got the advocates and then you've got the critiques. And then I think if you don't mind, I'll also say there's a third, you know, a third wave, which I think are kind of what Vince Horn calls second generation mindfulness. So I think these are kind of Buddhists who are really, you know, invested in, you know, secular mindfulness or secular forms of metta or compassion meditation, but are really kind of taken the critiques on board and are trying to, you know, revision, you know, deeper and more kind of ethical versions of secular mindfulness. So I do give some examples in my book, but I'd like to, you know, mention Courage of Care. So Courage of Care is a collective organization running out of the, East Bay maybe, or it's in San Francisco. And I think they're doing work which is kind of, you know, are thinking of mindfulness through a kind of critical lens, but still a commitment to teaching mindfulness outside of a traditional Buddhist context.
That's a fascinating way of explaining how these groups have responded to the critiques that are coming out. So in chapter 3, you look at sex scandals convert Buddhist groups. How have these been dealt with, and how has having to confront issues of sexual abuse reshaped convert Buddhism?
Yeah, this was, you know, one of the most interesting and also kind of challenging kind of chapters. So, you know, as you know, actual cases, not just allegations, but, you know, proper cases, proved cases, documented cases of sexual assault, abuse and misconduct have been, you know, documented since the 1980s across convert lineages. And I think in this, I've written before on this, in this topic, but in the book, I wanted to look at specific, there's a lot of different ways that communities have responded, really ranging from, you know, sticking their heads in the sand to, you know, reforming much more democratic structures and much more transparent policies. But what I look at in the book is one specific way in which communities have incorporated basically psychological, psychotherapeutic, psychoanalytical discourses and practices in the communities. And so essentially in these cases, I think, you know, the communities themselves or, you know, other community members have said, you know, the Buddhist training that we have received, at least as we have received it, does not contain enough resources in and of itself to prevent these abuses happening and also to respond adequately to these abuses. And so they've advocated for bringing in, you know, therapists to come and work with the communities, to, you know, institute psychotherapeutic training as part of, you know, the teacher training programs within these communities. And so I think in that chapter, I look at Barry Majid. So Barry Majid runs a sangha in New York City, and he's also a psychoanalyst himself. So he was, you know, I think already kind of geared to look at things through a psychoanalytic lens. He's a Dharma student of Charlotte Jocko Beck. And Charlotte, you know, so it's quite interesting because Charlotte Jocko Beck also in her books, which, you know, she had her own sangha, I think it was in California, but her books were also really influential, you know, to wider populations of Zen practitioners. And so she really drew attention to the ways in which certain aspects of emotional life weren't really addressed by Zen practice. And so I think Barry Majid, you know, basically took that further. So in his series of books, he really, you know, calls on other Zen practitioners to draw on these, you know, psychoanalytic bodies of knowledge to think about intersubjectivity, to think about narcissism, as part of their ongoing training, as, you know, Zen practitioners and Zen teachers. Grace Shreyason has done so much work. She's been a kind of phenomenal figure. She actually ran a training program. Unfortunately, she retired and the program's kind of ended for now, which I say unfortunately because I do think there's a real need for such programs. So I think her program was called Spot Training. And essentially what she would do was it was her and I think about another five senior Zen teachers. I think they were mostly from Soto Zen lineages across Sanghas, but all I think in Soto Zen. So they'd run, I think, 6 week or 8 week workshops at her monastery and her training center at the time in Northern California, where, you know, different, you know, priests would apply and then they'd do a lot of, you know, different kind of forms of training. One thing that they did, which I thought was quite interesting, was kind of role play. So they do, you know, role plays around how to maintain, you know, appropriate boundaries as a teacher and also as a student, you know, so she was, you know, sharing a lot of the material with me. And it would be like, okay, so, you know, you're a senior student and, you know, your, you know, her teacher makes this, you know, inappropriate remark about, you know, what something you're wearing or, you know, something that's, you know, really inappropriate, you know, sexualized, like how might you, you know, what's a good way to respond? So I think just, you know, very like on the ground kind of training that, you know, that wasn't, you know, that in the groups, because there was such an emphasis on, you know, meditation practice and maybe some ritual, of course, in Soto Zen, you know, those actual, you know, more interpersonal kind of trainings were not, you know, were not offered in, you know, via their own kind of Japanese teachers.
So this has been something that American Buddhists have really had to deal with that wasn't coming from the Asian Buddhist tradition.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's kind of really interesting because, I mean, again, you know, I think it's really important to remember that, you know, these changes, you know, they're a reaction to and a continuing conversation with the Buddhist modernist forms they inherited. So, you know, someone like Grace Shreyason, you know, she says explicitly, you know, we didn't get, you know, the kind of, you know, full-on training that a Japanese, you know, priest would get in Japan. You know, the tradition didn't come to us wholesale. You know, we did get this fragmented, you know, they got Buddhist modernism, you know. So some of the Buddhist practitioners themselves are recognizing, you know, what they inherited was, you know, a distinct form of Buddhism and not, you know, necessarily the whole picture. So in a way, you know, in some ways, I guess, you know, that made me interested, you know, to ask, well, you know, would it have been enough? You know, would it be enough just to get the full, you know, so as we're talking about, you know, Soto Zen, like, is it enough to get the full Soto Zen training? You know, if you went to Japan and you brought that, you know, those kind of structures back more, you know, complete, you know, would that be enough to prevent, you know, sexual abuse and sexual misconduct? And most of the, so I, you know, I asked the participants, the interviewees that, and most of them, you know, felt like, well, no, even if they did get the full training, it wouldn't be enough because, of course, you know, it's a different cultural context with, you know, different sexual, you know, mores and ethics and, you know, so I think, you know, that's a separate question. You know, one question is, you know, what are the limits of the Buddhist modernist forms themselves? And then, you know, would, you know, a more traditional Buddhist, you know, training, whatever, I mean, even to say that is somewhat speculative because, of course, you know, Buddhist modernism impacted, you know, the Japanese lineages on the ground as well. So in a sense, it's like, you know, I'm not sure that many people, that many people that I interviewed at least think, you know, there are enough resources in traditional, you know, Buddhism to traditional Zen or Zen modernism. Like, I think there is a recognition or a feeling that, you know, this is a unique, you know, cultural, sociocultural moment, an historic moment. And in a way, you know, new forms need to be introduced into Buddhism. But I should add that there are some people who reject that. There are some practitioners who also said, And I think I break this up in the book in a more kind of eloquent and coherent way. But there are, you know, there were practitioners who said, we don't need psychotherapy. All we actually need to do is follow Buddhist, you know, the Buddhist precepts properly. And if everyone just practices the Buddhist precepts, these problems won't occur, you know. Or if we, you know, have, you know, more, some people said if we had like more segregated communities, you know, gender wise, and the problems wouldn't occur. You know, that, obviously that's quite heterosexist. But what I want to point out is there are some practitioners who don't think that we need, you know, by we, I mean Buddhist communities need to bring in, you know, psychotherapy or communication training or, you know, these other new forms. You know, they just think if you just practice Buddhism properly, then there wouldn't be a, you know, i.e. as they understand traditional Buddhism, that there wouldn't be a problem. So it is quite complicated. There are these different, you know, these different positions in the wider field.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And so these different positions come up in chapter 4, especially relating to psychotherapy. Chapter 4 is titled Meditation and Awakening in the American Vipassana Network. And it looks at the goals of Buddhist practice. And as I see it, you talk about two main approaches, one that is more relational, that integrates insights from psychotherapy, and the one that is more traditional, meaning that it draws on the Buddhist canon and it is therefore somewhat more goal-oriented. Is that an accurate characterization?
Yeah.
And can you expand on these distinctions?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, as I say, you know, I started the book with the main question for me was, what is happening with Buddhist modernism? And so I take, you know, I wanted to give examples of the different lineages. So with the mindfulness chapter, I looked at, you know, what's happening with the Enlightenment lineage. And mindfulness, of course, you know, is a great example of the Enlightenment lineage. And then with the sex scandals chapter, I look at what's happening with Romanticism. Because, you know, psychology is, you know, modern to Romanticism. And so with this chapter, I wanted to focus on, you know, meditation as one of the key characteristics of Buddhist modernism. And what I found, so I thought, you know, the Insight community and, you know, the offshoots from the Insight community is a perfect kind of case study. And so, yeah, what I found was there were two, you know, main approaches that I had kind of, that I found within these communities. So I think one approach I call I call it the relational integrative. And so I use examples. So I look at Jack Kornfield as an example of a boomer teacher who really exemplifies the relational integrative current. And I look at Josh Korda as a Gen X teacher who kind of continues that relational integrative current. And then the second current I call the textual technical. And I think I look at, let's see, I look at pragmatic dharma as an example, and also this interest in the jhanas. And so with the I'll just talk about briefly each one. So with the the relational integrative current, I basically look at like how in like, you know, Jack Kornfield's kind of body of work, both his books, which have been, you know, massive bestsellers, hugely influential in shaping kind of the Insight community, and also I draw an ethnography that I did at Spirit Rock. I look at how he articulates meditation in a very therapeutic way. And so he talks about, you know, he also, it's really interesting because they also become gendered. So he talks about meditation as in a kind of feminine way, as a kind of, you know, using metaphors of receptivity and just kind of being with what is and not striving for meditation attainments. So he kind of rejects, you know, he kind of says, you know, the path of insight, you know, don't get hung up on it. It's just more like an aspiration rather than a reality. And it essentially kind of domesticates, you know, the Dharma. He talks about, you know, being with your family and family life as practice. And he actually identifies and legitimates his approach to meditation through Ajahn Chah from the Thai forest tradition. So, you know, just as a kind of some background information, you know, I'd say that the insight community has been really influenced by the Burmese lineage of Mahasi Sawadaw and also the Thai forest tradition of Ajahn Chah. And so he basically really says, you know, Ajahn Chah wasn't interested in attainment. He was much interested in integration and just meeting life on its own terms type of thing. And so I just give a lot of different examples of the way that approach to meditation shows up. And I say that, you know, one of the main kind of motifs in that lineage is basically a kind of rejection of this very, you know, intense meditation practice that you can go on retreat, you know, and get enlightened or, you know, reach the, you know, the stage of stream entry in, you know, 10 days. But then I look at, you know, the other stream in the insight community. I take pragmatic Dharma as one of the examples. And basically pragmatic Dharma is in some ways a kind of reaction against the kind of, you know, Jack Kornfield kind of domestication of Dharma. And they're really into, like, let's return to, you know, the Buddhaghosa's path of purification, you know, the stages of insight. And they're really excited about basically mapping meditation progress. And so if you go on the kind of pragmatic Dharma websites, you know, you'll see all of these textual references and, you know, these claims to by these, you know, meditators, you know, to have reached, like, you know, this stage of the path. And so they'll give a first person account of their meditation practice. And then they'll say, I reached, you know, this stage of, you know, Buddhaghosa, you know, using Buddhaghosa's kind of path of purification. You know, they'll draw on the texts, you know, the commentaries, the textual commentaries on meditation. And so I also notice there's also I gender that as masculine. And they also gender themselves as masculine. You know, a lot of those practitioners also claim this is a kind of alternative, you know, approach to, you know, this wishy-washy, you know, daily life as practice. So I basically track those two lineages. And then in the conclusion of the chapter, I basically look at the ways in which those lineages both continue, you know, the modernist emphasis on meditation, but also kind of push back against it as well. And so, for example, one way that the Jack Kornfield kind of relational integrative lineage pushes back against it is that it is very critical. It does tend to be really critical of that kind of intensive meditation retreat practice. Like, it is really calling for a recontextualization of meditation practice. Like it says, you know, meditation is just one part of the path, and it has been, you know, really overemphasized in, you know, at the start in our communities. But what's kind of interesting about it is that it doesn't go back to the traditional Noble Eightfold Path. It tries to open a new context. It tries to recontextualize it in a new container, which, you know, draws on, I guess, more kind of modernist elements. And then I think with the textual technical lineage, you know, in some ways that's a kind of hyper-modernity. So it really kind of runs with, you know, kind of the Buddhist modernist emphasis on meditation. But one interesting feature, and I think this is something Eric Braun's also written on, is that you do find there has been a huge interest in jhana meditation within these communities as well. And also a kind of interest in more, you know, kind of psychic phenomena and kind of, you know, these terms problematic, as I say, but, you know, the more kind of supernatural elements of, you know, Theravada Buddhism that were kind of discarded in the initial and in the initial modernization kind of movement. So again, in both lineages, you've got this kind of, you know, continuation, but also counter movements to modernity, which I think are very postmodern in that sense, that you do have this, you know, kind of contradictory, you know, both continuations and counterings kind of happening there. So yeah, it's a bit complicated, but I think that's a chapter which hopefully when the, you know, if listeners read the chapter, that the argument's a little more clear.
Right. So one of the things you've pointed to is the importance of context. And already you've mentioned that white privilege is in a really important context for understanding American Buddhism. In chapter 5, you focus specifically on race and racism in North American convert Buddhism. How have different groups addressed this problem? And how do people of color see themselves within a predominantly white Buddhist community?
Yeah, this was another really difficult chapter to write. And also, you know, especially as a white researcher, have to, you know, really be take a lot of care in how I represent Buddhists of color and represent them, you know, in a way that kind of, you know, advances them and, you know, doesn't kind of assimilate them to my scholarship. So I think, you know, essentially, you know, similar actually to the, you know, claims of sexual, you know, abuse and misconduct, you know, there's been work on trying to challenge racism and white privilege in convert communities has really been going on for over, you know, two decades in convert communities. You know, one landmark kind of document is Making the Invisible Visible, Healing Racism in Our Buddhist Communities. And that's a book it's kind of a booklet that's available free online. And I really urge, you know, listeners to kind of check it out. But that was presented, you know, at the turn of the millennium to the Buddhist Teachers Council at Spirit Rock. I think His Holiness the Dalai Lama was actually present. And, you know, the document opens and says, you know, for many years now, we've been trying to make, you know, teachers, white teachers and Sangha members aware that, you know, that, you know, the same kind of racism in larger society is happening also in our sanghas. But, you know, nothing really happened. Well, things were always happening, but I think the mainstream communities have been so resistant to really hearing, you know, these critiques and responding to them. But, you know, a lot of things have been happening, of course, you know, on the ground, Buddhists of color and their white allies have been, you know, working so hard for over two decades to make changes. But I think a lot of changes have happened recently in the last 5 years in terms of, you know, this work that's been happening, you know, on the margins and how exhausting must it have been for Buddhists of color and, you know, all this time. But, you know, it's finally, you know, coming into the mainstream. So in the chapter, you know, I'd say, you know, there are different communities that have kind of risen to the forefront. So I'd say, you know, first of all, East Bay Meditation Society in Oakland, California has been at the absolute forefront of racial justice work and diversity work. And, you know, some of the teachers there have been they've not only created a center from the start with the main intention to create a much more racially diverse center that actually looked like the community that it was placed in. But the teachers, you know, people like Larry Yang and Mushin Patricia Aikida and many more have been, you know, traveling to other Buddhist communities and doing work with them. And so in the book, I'll return to the community I look at in the book. In the book, I look at the Insight Community of Washington. It's a community that started, the lead teacher, the head teacher, the most well-known teacher there is Tara Brach. And so basically, you know, what happened in the, I offer a kind of short history of that community. And essentially, I think, you know, they started their work, I think, about 15 years. I think they started off with a small group, a mixed group of, you know, white Buddhists and Buddhists of color. That was their first attempt. And I think, you know, it really fell apart really quickly. You know, it wasn't, I think, you know, and the teachers said we didn't have the skills or the awareness to basically create a safe enough kind of container for the Buddhists of color. And so but essentially what grew out of that group was La Sarmiento developed, who identifies as a gender queer Buddhist of color. La started two groups, an affinity group for people of color and an affinity group for LGBTQI populations. And then a white Sangha member started a kind of white awareness group. And so, you know, you had these different groups within the larger Sangha doing the work, and they often faced a lot of resistance and hostility from the larger Sangha. You know, they were really, the larger Sangha were, I think, quite threatened. You know, a lot of the mainstream dominant cultures don't understand the need for distinct groups. And so they assume that the Sangha is already, you know, a unified, safe space. So they see the affinity groups as, you know, dividing an already united Sangha rather than as providing spaces for people who, you know, aren't the mainstream Sangha isn't, you know, a safe place for. So there were these, you know, separate groups happening, and then, you know, some, I think, really painful things happened in the community. And then I think the teachers and the white teachers and the white, you know, people in kind of leadership positions really realized that, you know, this was a really issue for the wider Sangha and not just for these, you know, marginalized populations. So I think they actually did a year-long training with Eleanor Hancock, who runs the White Awake trainings. I think it was a year longer, it could have been longer. And they also did a friendship group that ran, I think, for about a year and a half. And then they brought in, you know, diversity consultation. And so there's just so much work that, you know, happened in that Sangha. And there's so much work that needs to happen in so many Sanghas. I do want to give a shout out. I'm really excited. I'm an editor now for the Journal of Global Buddhism, and we're about to publish a fantastic article. There's three authors on the article. The only one whose name I can remember is Craig Haas right now. But that's a really very rigorously based social scientific study of, you know, the kind of work that needs to be done to bring more racial justice in these majority white Sanghas. So I think it's going to be a terrific resource for Buddhist communities. I also want to talk about the importance of the teacher training program. So the Insight Community, I think at one point there were something like 375 Insight teachers, trained teachers, and only I think only six of them identified as teachers of color. So, you know, the percentages were like horrifically low. And having, you know, teachers of color is so important, you know, to, you know, attract and to retain, you know, diverse kind of sanghas. And so the Insight Community really has prioritized racial diversity for its new teacher training program. But the history of that teacher training program is in itself a kind of heartbreaking history, and, you know, one that it was really hard as an ethnographer, you know, to track that, the history of that program, because when I started the chapter, the program was initially going to be run by both Spirit Rock and the Insight Meditation Society as a joint effort. And I actually wrote the first draft of the chapter under that assumption. And then, you know, the program, the training program broke down. And, you know, I think it was just an extremely, you know, exhausting and painful process for the people involved. And the end result is that Spirit Rock is running its own program and IMS is running its own program. But I think that is going to be a really, you know, big, I think it's going to have a really big impact on racial justice work, because I think there's, you know, it's going to, I think it's something like it's going to increase teachers of color by something like 330%. Because I think combined together, I think it's something like 80 or 90% of the trainees are, you know, teachers of color. So I'm really excited to see how those teachers, you know, take their training back into their local communities and the kind of, you know, wider impact that's going to have on the Insight community. So yeah, I hope a graduate student maybe picks up that project.
Right. So this is a place where what you talk about in chapter five really is ongoing, and there's more work to be done both within the communities and by scholars who are looking at these communities.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many levels to it. And I think one of the things that, you know, as someone, who also trying to, you know, work always to, you know, develop my own racial kind of justice awareness and skills and capacity, is it is an ongoing learning process, I think, for all, you know, white Buddhist scholars and practitioners. You know, one of the things that has kind of heartened me is to see that, you know, there is more white awareness groups happening in sanghas. And so, you know, historically, you know, there's been more, you know, there's been these affinity groups, affinity sits, you know, weekly sits for people of color, retreats for people, for Buddhists or people of color to do. But I think that, you know, I think white teachers are finally realizing, oh, this isn't like it's not a minority problem. It's a mainstream sangha problem. Like, if we want, you know, our sanghas to look like, you know, the communities, the cities that we are, you know, located in, you know, we have to change the culture of our sanghas. So, you know, one way that I think some, you know, some groups are trying to do that is by running these white awareness groups. So I was at the Soto Zen Buddhist Association conference, which is a conference for Soto Zen priests in North America. And I actually gave a keynote on Buddhism and whiteness. And I was really heartened to find, you know, several people kind of approached me and said, oh, you know, I'm running a center in Minnesota and we've been doing a white awareness group for the last, you know, 9 months, or I'm running a center in Oregon and we did, you know, 2 6-month, you know, white awake, white awareness kind of, you know, trainings. What does it mean to be white in the context of Buddhist teachings? So, you know, we're seeing these kind of, in a way, they're like new Buddhist practice forms, right? It's a kind of combination of thinking about, you know, the awarenesses and the forms of knowledge that critical race theory and diversity and inclusion trainings give, and, you know, putting those kind of forms of knowledges and practices in dialogue with Buddhist practice. So in a way, you know, like similar to what I was talking about earlier, you know, with the, you know, the dialogue between depth psychology and Buddhism that's been happening and accelerated after the, you know, in the wake of the sexual abuse and misconduct, we're also seeing, you know, another dialogue between, you know, critical race kind of consciousness and Buddhism, you know, and I, as a, you know, as an ethnographer of, you know, contemporary Buddhism, I find that tremendously exciting, as well as ethically, you know, very positive. But I also should add that as well as these groups, you know, starting to kind of form, and there's also a tremendous opposition towards them. You know, so there's a lot of Buddhists who feel, you know, that this isn't Buddhism, and this is, you know, basically, essentially like the neo-Marxist, you know, really, you know, I'm seeing all the time, you know, even tracking some of my own research online, you know, the common thread is like, you know, this is a the neo-Marxist takeover of Buddhism. This is, you know, the leftist kind of takeover. This is not real Buddhism. So there is, you know, considerable I wouldn't even say backlash, because I think the opposition has been ongoing. You know, the groups face opposition in bringing racial justice work to the sanghas, and there's continual opposition when the work starts. And I think that the opposition, you know, I think it's also quite, it's a bit like the mindfulness kind of responses, because within the opposition, I'm more like, again, in quotations, a more traditionalist, how does this kind of fit with Buddhism? And, you know, isn't this a little in tension with, you know, Buddhist practices? And then I'm seeing a more what feels almost like a kind of right wing kind of, you know, what kind of this, you know, I've been playing with the term the Buddhist culture wars, you know, where it's like, this is the leftist takeover. Right. There's clearly like the person who's delivering this critique is clearly speaking from a kind of right wing perspective, you know, which is a little different than the traditionalist kind of perspective. The kind of merging a kind of traditional Buddhism with a kind of right-wing politic, I would say. So that's like so fascinating to me in the way in which, you know, there are these, you know, I'd say sexual abuse and misconduct and racial justice are becoming these real like sites of struggle in American Buddhism in ways that is quite analogous to, you know, the culture wars in Christianity, you know, where you've got the kind of conservative, you know, versus kind of more liberal kind of Christian kind of debates and hermeneutics around what real Christianity is or what real Buddhism is.
Right.
Yeah, so, really fascinating. Sorry, I'm kind of rambling.
So in chapter six, you talk about technology in a convert Buddhist context. And I assume this is less controversial than some of these other issues, but I don't know. So can you give us a sense of how would you characterize the use of technology in these contexts and how has it changed over time?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is maybe a little less, definitely, I felt, yeah, less controversial, but also quite complex. So this was a chapter that I was kind of most looking forward to in the sense that I was just planning originally to use my Buddhist Geeks article. You know, it was like I can use one previous, you know, published article. So it was like, oh, that would be my easy chapter. But I'd written, you know, already on Buddhist Geeks for the Journal of Global Buddhism. But essentially what happened, again, it was kind of a little frustrating. So I was just about to, you know, I thought I was nearly finished with the book. And then I suddenly got an email from Vince Horn, who is, you know, one of the founders of Buddhist Geeks, that, you know, informed me that Buddhist Geeks was dead, you know, that they were basically, you know, closing Buddhist Geeks and starting their, you know, their new project of Meditate.io. So that was, you know, a bit stressful for me because I basically had to kind of rewrite a new chapter again. And so that chapter basically looks at the trajectory of Buddhist Geeks and Meditate.io and asks, you know, what does it tell us about Buddhism and technology? And so I think, you know, essentially, you know, technology, you know, I'd say one way that technology has impacted Buddhist modernism is through generational shifts. So Vince Horn and Emily Horn and Ryan Oakley, I think his name is, he was one of the original founders, you know, from the very start of their project with Buddhist Geeks, you know, they identified themselves as millennials. And they said, you know, we want to do Buddhism differently than the boomer generation. You know, they didn't say modernists, you know, because obviously they're theoretical terms, but they said, you know, boomer Buddhism, you know, is one thing and we want to, you know, do something different with technology. And so they basically, you know, really, they claim technology and a kind of fluency and excitement and enthusiasm for technology as one of the defining characteristics of the millennials. And so I think, you know, they are much more in Buddhist Geeks, you know, one of the first things I say about it in my analysis of it as postmodern is they reject Buddhism as a total system. Like they explicitly reject that Buddhism has all the answers. And they say, let's bring in, you know, like technology, you know, let's bring in, you know, these different, you know, like artificial intelligence, like gaming culture, like what can they add, you know, to a kind of post-Buddhist kind of spirituality. And so they kind of, you know, they reject the meta-narrative of Buddhism, which, you know, meta-narratives, of course, also really associated with modernity. And they also really blur the line between the secular and the religious. And so they're really which, you know, is a mark of the post-secular, which I argue in the book is, you know, a kind of subsect or a kind of development out of the postmodern. So they're really interested in, you know, bringing Buddhist practice into these, you know, unusual spheres, you know, into spaces that you wouldn't normally associate with Buddhist practice. So, you know, one space would be, you know, the computer, you know, Buddhism as play. So in the early Buddhist Geeks conferences, there was a lot of presentations on like how game culture, you know, gaming culture could be a form of Buddhist practice, both explicitly like designing games that had explicit Buddhist themes and also more implicitly. And then they're also really embracive of apps. So, you know, I think one of the early apps, what was it called? I've forgotten now. Sorry, Buddhify. So, you know, Buddhify is this kind of app which, you know, you can meditate while you're, you know, at the gym, you know, while you're on the train. And so, again, it's all about this kind of blurring of, you know, bringing Buddhism out of the retreat center or the monastery or, you know, even the kind of, you know, convert kind of living room into these kind of funky millennial urban spaces. And then, you know, they also kind of embrace a kind of entrepreneurial kind of spirit. So I just, you know, look at different, you know, different examples of that, different kind of Buddhist apps. They develop, you know, ways in which you can, you know, play, you know, do like two-person meditation. It's very playful. I think one of the things about Buddhist Geeks especially is it really had this spirit of playfulness. And again, if you look at, you know, the sociology of religion, you know, one of the marks of postmodern religion, you know, in the sociology of religion and that body of work is, you know, religion as play. So David Lyon, he's been a big figure in postmodern kind of religion. You know, he talks about Disney, you know, as a form of religion. So I was seeing all of these parallels with the kind of gaming culture, you know, with as essentially as I was thinking of them as kind of bricolage and kind of postmodern forms of kind of religion. And then I think, other ways, you know, I think a big way is this, the kind of appearance of the online sangha and virtual communities. You've seen, you know, that's been a big feature of Buddhist Geeks and Meditate.io and also secular Buddhism, actually. And so you also have, you know, the online communities are so interesting because, again, there's a real range of types of online communities. Like even in, you know, the short time that I was working on it was a few years, you know, even in the, you know, in 3 years of 3 or 4 years of, you know, tracking these communities, you know, I'd go to one community and it'd be really, you know, thriving. Like every day there'd be new posts. And then, you know, I'd get back to it 2 years later to check, you know, a footnote and I'd see like, oh, it's gone. You know, there's been no activity for like 3 months. And so I was noticing there's these kind of, you know, like mushrooms were kind of blooming and then dying. But, you know, on the one hand, so these kind of temporal kind of communities that seem to address a need in the moment and then kind of dissolve or be absorbed back into another, you know, into other forms. But then on the other hand, you know, there's communities that seem to be really solid. And, you know, often when I, you know, if I interviewed some people in some communities, you know, they would often say, I would be lost without this community because the nearest actual Buddhist Sangha to me is like, you know, 60 minutes drive, you know, and so it was they felt it was a kind of lifeline. So you have got a lot of, you know, variation with these new kind of virtual communities. And then I think you're also seeing hybrids where, you know, physical Buddhist communities are, you know, more and more embracing technology to, you know, promote their teachings outside of their own geographical range and also to provide links with people who maybe, you know, move away themselves. And, you know, another really fascinating element, which I don't go into in the book, but, you know, you're now also seeing that transmissions, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, you're getting transmissions that are happening virtually now. Like I was at a ceremony where I received, you know, a transmission and a kind of, you know, practice permission to do a Tibetan practice, you know, virtually, which was kind of blowing my mind. So there's just, again, just a lot of variation that's happening with the intersections of Buddhism, you know, and technology, from play to, you know, quite serious traditional ritual, but just happening in, you know, via virtual means.
Right. And so you've gestured at some of the generational differences in the use of technology, and you turn to that really fully in chapter 7, talking about generational shifts, especially between the boomers and the Gen Xers. How would you just briefly kind of characterize that change and what the Gen Xers see as the future of the Buddhist convert mood, Buddhist converts?
So the chapter only engages Gen X teachers. So I want to acknowledge, you know, that it's really how they see themselves. It's their aspiration. It's their ideal, their self-image, you know. So I want to make sure I qualify that, because, you know, I think, you know, if I'd also been able to include, you know, boomer voices in that chapter, I'm sure the picture would be more complicated. But my focus was on this. I wanted to understand how Gen X saw the boomers and how they saw themselves. So the Gen Xers basically see the boomers as very individualistic. That was one of the first themes that came out. Like, they talked about the boomers as, they used language like, you know, they are rock stars, they are mavericks. You know, they are, you know, individual founders. They're very charismatic, but they're not really good at relationship. So there was a feeling that, you know, that the boomers, you know, were like, you know, at the front of the ship, you know, but weren't great at, you know, mediating, you know, responsibility, building community. They kind of lacked both interpersonal relational skills and also kind of more organizational skills. So that was, you know, a kind of, I guess it was a critique of the boomers. They also felt a lot of the Gen X teachers, especially from the Zen lineage, were really struggling with feeling that their teachers, you know, in some cases they'd actually left their teachers, that they didn't want to hand, they didn't trust them. You know, they had this sense that they were ready to like be fully individuated and, you know, full teachers on their own. And they kind of felt like their teachers were kind of holding them back kind of a little bit. So it was quite interesting, you know, I always think through a psychoanalytic lens because I'm also trained in psychoanalysis. So I felt like there was a lot of individuation kind of struggles happening. And so by contrast, because often, you know, I noticed the Gen Xers kind of define themselves in opposition to what the boomers were. So they saw themselves as much more kind of relational. They saw themselves as much more interested in building kind of peer relationships. They felt that there was a lack. Another thing about the boomers was that they felt there was a lack of transparency around, you know, certain decisions and how, you know, especially how power was kind of negotiated in, you know, in the different communities. And so by contrast, they said, we want to be more transparent. Like, transparency was a word that kept on coming up. We want to be accountable to each other. You know, so they had this sense of, you know, that they didn't just want to be accountable to their teachers above them. They wanted to be much more accountable to their, you know, peers, their Dharma siblings. And then there was just a sense of like, they talked about things like how conferences, you know, were run by, you know, boomer teachers. And they, you know, talked about it as it's very hierarchical. It's like, you know, there's the head teacher at the, you know, the top of the room. It's a kind of talking head approach. And we want to do it more like, you know, peer-to-peer activity and, you know, more collective and, you know, have, you know, groups of people running workshops and have, you know, a lot of feedback. And so there was a kind of organizational, there was a really distinct kind of organizational style that was coming through with the Gen Xers. And in a way, you know, I think you're seeing that also in the academy, right? You know, the difference between traditional teacher modes and kind of student-centered classrooms. So I think, you know, that we are seeing these cultural shifts in a lot of different, you know, spaces. And I think that that was, you know, that's also being reflected in these Dharma kind of cultures. Another thing was, you know, they recognized that, you know, some of the boomers had, you know, boomers, you know, do tend to be liberal, and that they had, you know, for example, you know, made strides in, you know, moving towards greater kind of gender equality in terms of, you know, the number of female teachers that there were. But they felt that, you know, that they weren't great with like intersectional, you know, kind of politics. So, you know, they, one of the three things at the start of the Garrison conference, where there was a kind of semi kind of formal ritualized transmission kind of ceremony between the boomers and Gen Xers, the Gen Xers presented the boomers with three statements. And one of the kind of aspirations of what they want to do as a generation. And one of their aspirations was to really, really focus on inclusivity and diversity, you know, especially around race, sexual orientation, gender, you know, diversity, not just women, but, you know, trans identity and gender queer identity. So I basically theorize it as a shift from a kind of, you know, more mainstream liberalism to a more left-wing progressive kind of politic. So, you know, like from Hillary Clinton to kind of, you know, Bernie Sanders might be a kind of easier way of expressing it.
Okay. So in chapter 8, you move towards a conclusion. And as part of this, you are outlining three turns in North American convert Buddhism: the critical turn, the collective turn, and the contextual turn. I wonder if you could give us a brief sense of what these are.
Yeah, I noticed that you keep on mentioning brief. Sorry, it's quite hard for me. I'm a bit of a talker. So the critical turn, I essentially define it as referring to just a kind of growing awareness within these meditation-based convert lineages of their own limitations. So if you look at a book like James Coleman, The New Buddhism, you know, there's this real sense of enthusiasm in these, you know, meditation-based convert lineages. Like, we're going to fashion this new Buddhism, you know, that's full of, you know, hierarchy and, you know, sexism and misogyny, you know. And I think that, you know, there was this kind of sense of a kind of utopia that you also see, like, say, in the mindfulness revolution. You know, mindfulness is going to change the world. And then, you know, there's a kind of realism kind of, you know, hits in, you know, that while meditation practice isn't changing the world, you know, that we, you know, we've been a really sincere sangha for 20 years, but we still had this, you know, sexual, you know, misconduct kind of crisis. So the critical term, you know, just kind of refers to that, that the sanghas are reflecting critically on some of their own assumptions and limitations. The collective turn really refers, I think, to this, you know, realization, you know, of just how, how individualistic the sanghas have tended to be, and that there has been, you know, a neglect of sangha and of community. So, you know, the collective turn is like, you know, let's build up community. Let's build up inclusive communities. Another way that the collective turn manifests, I think, is really in this, you know, emerging rhetoric of collective liberation. that you're really seeing, especially in engaged Buddhism, which is, you know, just basically the argument that, you know, individual liberation isn't enough, that we have to, you know, address, you know, collective sources of dukkha, you know, of suffering, you know, including like structural racism, environmental, you know, crises. So that would be, you know, the kind of collective turn. And then the contextual turn is really, again, just a kind of awareness within Buddhist communities and also the, you know, the mindfulness movement as a kind of heir to the Buddhist convert communities, of the ways in which how crucial context is in shaping Buddhist practice. And so, you know, that can refer to, you know, an awareness of how power and privilege kind of shapes Buddhist practice. But it can also, where, you know, it can also refer to, you know, the awareness of, you know, how practicing intensive meditation out of a larger, you know, communal and soteriological context, you know, can be quite dangerous. So, you know, for example, there's a lot of interesting work now being done on trauma and meditation. You know, Willoughby Brittany, is it Willoughby Britton or Willoughby Brittany? I forgot. Yeah. She, you know, she's doing some really interesting work on, you know, the dangers of decontextualized meditation practice. So that's really different work than racial justice and power and privilege work. But in both cases, there is, you know, this understanding that context is crucial, you know, that practices, you know, are different, you know, in different contexts, essentially, and discourse. Buddhist teachings and practices, you know, they're not like, you know, Platonic forms. They're always taking place in specific contexts and are cut through with those contexts. So they're the kind of, yeah, I hope that's a kind of short summary of those three turns.
Right. So you've been really generous with your time today. And I wonder if we can ask you one more question.
Yeah, of course.
What's next? What's your new research project on? Can you give us a preview?
So, yeah, no, thanks for letting me talk about that just briefly. So I'm working on a new book with Amy Langenberg. Amy is a colleague and a friend. She's a specialist in Buddhist sexual ethics and Buddhist feminism. And she's a, you know, she reads Pali and Tibetan, and I do contemporary ethnography. And so we're basically combining our skills, and we are doing a whole book on the sexual misconduct and sexual abuse cases across Buddhist lineages. So essentially we're hoping to structure it by giving three case studies, one from the Insight community. We're hoping to do a case study of Noah Levine and the Against the Stream, you know, case that's been happening this year. And we also want to do a case study from the Zen community, American Zen, and from American Tibetan Buddhism. And so we're hoping to, you know, really kind of go into more depth with, you know, what's kind of been happening with the sexual abuse and misconduct. And we're also really interested in the ways in which Buddhists are responding to these, you know, issues, and how that's shaping new forms of Buddhist practice and new forms of Buddhist communities. So yes, I'm super excited. I think it's going to be a very sensitive project. So, you know, we want to, you know, take our time with it and give it the care and attention that it needs. But I'm really excited to be working on that with Amy.
Anne, that sounds fascinating. I want to thank you for being on the show today, and I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. Thanks for the opportunity.
I'm Natasha Heller, and this has been New Books in Buddhist Studies. Thank you for listening.